May Morin, today is the 24th of September, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Lloyd Dobbins, class of 1957.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you to Washington and Lee in the first place?
My brother was here. He was a senior the year I was a freshman. He was also in journalism school, although he didn't work in it very long after he graduated. And it was easier for the family if we were both in one place. He and I both wanted to go to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but in those days for out-of-state residents it was too expensive, and it may be hard to believe now, but Washington and Lee was less expensive, a situation which no longer prevails. But that was basically it. We both wanted to be writers or reporters, and in those days if you wanted to be a writer you had to be a reporter, because newspapers and news magazines were the only people who hired them that we knew of. Mm-hmm. Turned out not to be true, but so what?
So had you come to visit Washington and Lee when your brother was there?
Mm-mm. There was no point to it. He said it was a nice place, and that was that.
So do you remember your first impressions when you first got here?
Yeah, it was a tiny place. But it was bigger than where I'd been, because I'd been at Fork Union Military Academy for 9 years, and that's out in the middle of absolutely no place. So it looked to me like quite a pleasant town. You have to remember in those days there were the southern end was here, but not much else by way of restaurants. There was no liquor by the drink in the 50s in Virginia. There were two beer joints, neither one of which has survived. Doc's Corner Store and Jabbo's. Jabbo's was on Main Street, and Doc's Corner Store was on the corner of Jackson and Nelson, where the Bank of Rockbridge ATM machine now is, and I guess it's a print shop. I haven't been in, so I'm guessing from the sign in the window.
Did you frequent Jabbo's?
No, I preferred Doc's Corner Store, the reason being that my brother worked there as a waiter. So we could overcome certain obstacles like my age.
Well, that was awfully convenient.
Wasn't it just? Yes. Actually, I never had any trouble with my age, because I always looked older when I was here. I remember that when we were having fraternity parties in my freshman year, I would take my freshman beanie off, put it in my pocket. In those days, it was shirt, coat, and tie. So I put it in my jacket pocket and walk into the ABC store and order the booze for the weekend party. No one ever asked me my age. I filled out all the little forms to transport more than 5 gallons, and I was at the time 17.
Good Lord. So you were here in the days of freshman beanies.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, freshman beanies and hazing and fraternities and all that stuff that's now been done away with. Mercifully.
Do I take it these are not fond memories?
Oh, it's an irritant, nothing more. It's something you live through because you live through it. But I never, for the life of me, I cannot figure out what freshman beanies were for. It never made sense to me. Of course, no one asked me whether it made sense or not, so it really didn't matter.
How did the Assimilation Committee function? And did they really go after people?
Which one was the Assimilation Committee?
I think they were the ones who, if you didn't wear your beanie, I think they were the ones who came after you.
Oh, yeah. If they were the clothes people, the Assimilation Committee enforced the rules rather strictly. I was up in front of them, several times.
Oh, tell me about that.
No, I couldn't see the point. I understood the point of wearing a tie on campus. I never saw the point of wearing a tie if I was going to Doc's Corner Store to get sloshed on beer. I mean, you know, a drunk in a tie is just as drunk as a drunk without a tie. So I'd take the tie off, and somebody would turn me in. They would call me up and explain that the tradition of the university required that I wear a tie. And I said, no, it doesn't work that way. Traditions don't require anything. A tradition is not enforced. You either do it or you don't do it. So if you tell me it's a regulation that I wear a tie, fine, then I'll wear a tie. And I never got fined because they never had an answer for me. They couldn't quite explain. I mean, The Rent on Five this week has a headline that I just love. 1996 Convocation, a New Tradition. I'm sort of trying to puzzle out what a new tradition means. I really don't know. But they had some very silly rules in those days. On the other hand, I knew them when I came here, before I came here. I mean, they made it very clear that if you went, this is what you were going to do. So I can't really complain that I didn't know what I was getting into. I just thought it was sort of an obligation that I should rebel, see if I could make their lives as miserable as they occasionally made mine. And I think I was successful.
So I take it you didn't join the Assimilation Committee when your turn came around?
No, nor was I ever invited.
Was one invited to join the Assimilation Committee?
As I remember, yes. I would hate to swear to that, but as I remember, that was the process.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Well, I remember H. Merrill Plaisted III became a member of the Assimilation Committee, and H. Merrill Plaisted III was the best-dressed young man I have ever known in my entire life. I never saw him in 4 years when he was not wearing a tweed jacket. I mean, in the springtime, when a tweed jacket was singularly inappropriate. That's what H. Merrill Plaisted III had. And whatever was fashionable, he had it first. I mean, he really cared. And I hope in life he has done well, because he dressed for it.
You haven't followed his career.
No. I mean, I just remember him as, wondering how much money he actually spent every year. So he rarely wore the same jacket twice that you would notice. I mean, I just wondered what he did and what he might have done with all that money had he not spent it on Harris tweed jacket. None of my business, so it doesn't matter.
Well, the issue of dress seems to have been really important around here.
It was. It was very important. My roommate in my senior year was a man named Jerry Hopkins, who went on to become a writer. And Jerry's way of rebellion was he lived in New Jersey, so he would go to some place in Paramus and buy day-glow orange shirts and chartreuse ties and these wonderfully outrageous combinations of things and wear them. And since he was within regulation, of course, he could never be called up before the Assimilation Committee. Although his goal was to be the worst-dressed person on campus, and he achieved it. And that was his rebellion. And it was terribly important. And, the Lord people would talk to us, and Jerry, and ask him, couldn't he just make an effort to try and dress more gentlemanly, which was the word used. And his reply was probably not recordable, but it equated to no. And he never did. I mean, he never changed. And as soon as he left college, he burned all those stupid shirts and ties. He didn't like them himself.
And did all of this come from your fellow students? Or were you getting pressure from the faculty?
Faculty never mentioned my dress to me, nor did they ever mention it to Jerry, except Pax Davis once laughed so hard I thought he was going to fall out of his chair when Jerry came in and striped shirt and a patterned tie. And I mean, it was ugly. Really, truly ugly. And Pax just laughed hysterically, thought it was wonderful, couldn't have cared less. No students. In those days, the faculty, to the best of my knowledge, didn't care about it. Students did.
So you mentioned Lexington being a big place from your perspective.
Well, yeah. The only thing at Fork Union Military Academy is Fork Union Military Academy. And a service station.
How did you get here?
How did I get here?
In 53. How did one arrive in Lexington in 53?
By car. I lived in Newport News, Virginia, so it was a fairly easy drive even in those days. And my father and mother brought me up with my clothes, which was about all you brought in those days, and I think I had a gooseneck lamp. And you reported to the freshman dorm, and that was that. Everything else was furnished. Maybe I had some sheets, I just don't remember. But everything I had could be carried in suitcases. I had two suitcases, that was it.
All those terrace tweed jackets could be carried in two suitcases?
Well, since I didn't have any, the jackets I had fit quite nicely.
So you arrived in Lexington. What was your impression of the town?
Well, see, I didn't get to see the town very much, just to drive through and go to the freshman dorm, and then you were busy as heck because you then went to freshman camp.
Tell me about freshman camp.
I don't remember anything about it except you had to go and you wore casual clothes, no ties, no. It was across a weekend, and things were just explained to you of how the campus worked, how classes worked, who was responsible for what, who your advisor would be, and the dean in those days stood by the path that led to the dining hall, and you were required to wear name tags. And we would all walk past him. It was the only way to get to the dining hall. And he never, after that, forgot your name. He looked at you and your name tag one time, and that was it. If he saw you years later, he would call you by name. Damnedest display of memory I've ever seen.
Who is this?
Francis Pendleton Gaines.
Oh, President Gaines.
Oh, President, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, that was it. He really could be amazing.
Yeah, he seems to have been quite a character.
I don't know. I think that was probably the last time I ever saw him, other than just, you know, casual observation around the campus. I think he spoke at a couple of things I was required to attend, and that was it. He's a neat man. And that's all I remember about camp. It's boring. You learned a lot that you needed to know to start classes on, I would suppose, Monday. And then other than that, I remember nothing about it. Then in those days, very early on, was Rush Week for the fraternities. And that was, you know, sort of running around frantically.
And you joined?
Kappa Sigma. My brother was a member. Took care of that problem.
So had you already decided that was what you were going to do?
I think it was kind of a foregone conclusion. The other fraternities, you know, were pleasant enough to invite me to their parties and things, but they knew I was going to be a Kappa Sigma. So they let it go.
And was that a good match for you?
I suppose so. I got to be president of the chapter, and then I haven't done anything with it since I graduated, because in the second semester of my senior year, when I was the chapter president, Jerry Hopkins' brother was blackballed, and he quit the fraternity, and I didn't quit because I was the president. I just left and never had anything to do with it again.
Tell me what you mean, blackballed.
Oh, if one member of the chapter voted against, that was it. You would not be asked to join. And the vote was taken with a cigar box with a hole in the top and a whole bunch of white and black marbles and a little container. And they went around first, and everybody reached in and got what they wanted. And then the cigar box came right behind, and whoever was chapter president opened it up, and if there was anything black in there, that was the end of that guy. So Jerry's brother John, who came, same as I did. Jerry was the older brother, and his brother came in his freshman year. When Jerry was a senior, brother was a freshman, who wanted to join Kappa Sig, and somebody blackballed him, and so Jerry quit, which I think is perfectly reasonable.
I never knew that blackballing was literally a blackball.
It is quite literally, in this case, a black marble, and I suppose that's rather standard.
Wow. Girls don't do these kinds of things.
Thank God. They really are kind of silly. But, because everybody in the chapter, except that one guy, obviously voted for Jerry's brother. You know, he's, you know, what are you going to do? You certainly won't blackball somebody's brother, but somebody did. So. And I've always wondered whether it was because of John, who got blackballed, or Jerry, who didn't. Jerry could be obstreperous.
So take me to a fraternity party back in those days.
Well, in the first place, there were no co-eds. So most fraternity parties were held on Saturday night, so that you would have time on Saturday afternoon, because there were Saturday classes in those days. I don't know if there still are, because I don't have one. To drive to Hollins, Randolph-Macon, Southern Sim, infrequently, Sweetbriar. There's one in Harrisonburg, but I always forget the name of it. And pick up your date and come back. And you would have made arrangements at one of the rooming houses for your date to have a room. And that's where you'd take her and you'd pick her up at the appropriate time for dinner after she had changed clothes. And you'd go out to dinner, and then you'd get to the party, 7:30 or 8 o'clock. There was always a band, and there was always an open bar, because liquor was perfectly legal as long as you didn't sell it. So we didn't sell it, we just gave it away. And by about 10:30, almost everybody there was in the bag, and by midnight it was a guaranteed certainty. And at Kappa Sig, on Sunday morning, we would mix up a huge vat of milk punch, which is ice cream, milk, and brandy. And that would cure the hangover. And then just after lunch, you would get in the car and drive your date back to wherever her college was. Come back on Sunday night, finish up the milk punch, and start classes Monday morning.
Did studying figure into anything anywhere?
Oh, yeah. Most of us studied quite hard, but not on Saturday night. I strongly suspect we studied more during the week than the students do now. In journalism school, it was a rare day when I didn't have two or three or four stories to write. And I would quite often still be writing at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning to meet the deadline. And everybody else was doing the same thing. They were very demanding and not very understanding.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Professors I work with now tend to see their job more as helping the students learn if they want to. And if they don't want to learn, you can't teach them anyway, so why bother? But in those days, the professor saw his job as, by God, he would beat it into you no matter what it took. So if you were having trouble, he wouldn't particularly help you. He would just give you additional homework to help you on your way, which, of course, didn't help a damn thing.
Who are we talking about here? Tell me about faculty who were
most
important to you.
Most of them I've forgotten. The two who were important to me were in journalism school, Pax Davis and O.W. Regal. And until Pax died, I stayed in touch with both of them. I'm still in touch with Tom. I was at a club meeting with him last Monday night. He is very proud of the fact that in the second semester of my senior year, I flunked the motion picture and television. Of course, he taught and went on to have a reasonable career in television. I reminded him of that on my 25th graduation anniversary, and had found the report card so that I could demonstrate I was telling the truth. He said, I couldn't have done that. I said, you did. I refused to go to class. I didn't have to. I had unlimited cuts. And there were 8 of us in the class at the beginning. And Tom and the other 7 students were interested in avant-garde motion pictures, and I wasn't. I thought they were boring. I thought they didn't do anything. I like telling stories. If you're not going to tell me a story with a film, don't make the film. And so after, I guess I went to 3 classes and argued with everybody in there, and it suddenly occurred to me one day, why am I doing this? I'm taking all the fun out of it for them and making myself angry. So I called Tom and told him I wasn't going to come anymore. And at the end of the semester, he called me at the Kappa Sig House and said if I would come down and sign a blue book, the exam book that you took in those days, he'd give me a C, because I could have gotten a C just by wandering in every now and then. But he really would rather give me an F, but he didn't want to jeopardize my graduation. And I said, I have about 30 more credits than I need, so why don't you just give me the F and let's be done with it. And he said, please go check at the registrar. And if you really have extra credits, I'll give you an F and take three of them away. So I had a reasonable request, so I went to the registrar. He said, geez, you got 30 extra credits. And I called Tom. He said, oh, good. And gave me an F. The only F I ever got in my life. I just thought it was funny as hell.
That's great. What, did they ever get around to talking about television in the class?
Television in 1957 didn't get talked about.
And yet it was a course on film and television.
Well, because television news started in 1953 or 52, during the Korean War, or just at the end of the Korean War. And they were aware that sooner or later they were going to have to start teaching this stuff. Now, why they put it with motion pictures was because it had pictures, right? So they didn't put it in the radio course, where reasonably you would find it. Radio was taught separately and very extensively. But television, that was the one course we had then. And nobody wanted to go into it. I went into it not because I wanted to, but because the Times and World News offered me $67.50 a week as a cub reporter, and WDBJ, which the Times World Corporation owned, offered me $75 a week. That was a no-brainer as far as I was concerned.
Pretty good reason.
And I figured I can always get out of this stuff and, you know, go back to my first love, magazines and books. And I did. It just took until 1986.
Now, you were talking about having a lot of deadlines for your classes. Mm-hmm. Were the deadlines for the classes or for Ringtum Phi or?
All of the above. I worked at Ringtum Phi. I worked for Frank Parsons in the University News Bureau. I was a stringer for the Rockridge County News, which is now the News Gazette. And I was a stringer for the Roanoke Times and World News. I worked for anybody who would pay me money.
Tell me what it means to be a stringer in Lexington.
That's wonderful. Well, first off, do you know what the term means?
Okay. Tell.
A stringer. I went down and applied for a job because Pax Davis said they were looking for somebody who could write, and I was a good writer in the class. So I went down and talked to Matthew W. Paxton III, who is now retired. He was then a fairly young man. And he hired me for 11.5 cents a column inch. So if you didn't produce, you didn't get paid. Now, the way you measure your inches, if you take a string given to you by the editor and you tie a knot in one end, and then you just move it down all the columns, all the little articles that you've written, including pictures that you've taken, and tie a knot in the other end when you reach the end of what you've written, and you give it to the editor and he measures it against the yardstick. And then he calculates that times 11.5 cents. I made a great deal of money because eventually he trusted me enough to leave on vacation, which he hadn't had in a long time. And I got 11.5 cents a column inch for the entire paper, advertising and all, because I was the editor that week, which was a substantial check in those days. And then at the University News Bureau, I got 75 cents an hour. And I've really forgotten what the Times and World News paid because I didn't get that many stories in. But it was no more than that. And one of my functions was the far-flung correspondents, which are generally little old ladies in various communities, would send in their weekly stories about the covered dish suppers and the Sunday services, and I had to edit them. And I got paid 11.5 cents a column inch to edit them after Mr. Paxton carefully explained to me that what he was looking for in editing those was not change of content. He knew what they were. Don't get us sued, don't libel anybody, and get the verb tense right. Otherwise, leave it alone. If you offend those people, they won't send their copy anymore. And he was absolutely right. But it was great training. because the more you wrote, the more money you got. So you learned to write all stories quite long. So you learned what made them long. So when I got into television, it was very easy to make them short because you knew where all the padding was. In its own way, it was probably the best television training I got while I was here.
Isn't that interesting?
It's just one of those things that, you know, as you learn to write long, it never occurs to you until you need it that you're also learning to write short just by taking all the long stuff out. And so when I started working at WDBJ and they said, you know, keep it to a minute, I knew what a minute was. You know, take the long stuff out, hey, there's a minute. Worked fine.
So what kind of stories, were there any big stories?
Not in terms of news. I did a couple of features that they liked a lot. One of them was about Charlie the Certified Dog at BMI, who used to attend classes over there and was well-loved by the Dates of WNL students. On Saturday night, he would pick a fraternity house and just sort of wander in. And he would go downstairs to the lounge, where all the lounges were, and he would find an absolutely adorable co-ed from someplace else and sit on the sofa with her and drink her beer out of her paper cup all night. And no one ever refused him that I saw. And then somebody shot him to death about 6 months later.
Oh.
It was a great scandal in Rockbridge County that somebody had shot Charlie the Certifiable Dog. It was a spaniel of some kind. And really was very nice and very sweet. He attended classes at BMI and people just accepted him as, you know, Charlie the Certified Dog. And then I did a long feature on the Rockbridge County Fire and Rescue Service, which was a single unit in those days, which made the Fire and Rescue Service very happy because not much had ever been written about them. They were a very good group. And mostly I just covered news events, county supervisors, city council, courts, cops, the stuff you cover.
Were you covering events at Washington and Lee?
No, except that I was the University of News Bureau student assistant. So I had a deal with Pax Davis. On my Beats reporting, which I had to do for class, I would put in two carbons, if you remember back to when we said things like carbons, and I would type three copies of the same story. One I would turn in to him as my class assignment, one I would give to Frank Parsons in case he had any interest in it for the University News Bureau, and one would go to the Rockbridge County News. So I would get my grade, but I would also get paid 75 cents by Frank and about 11 and a half cents a column inch by Mr. Paxton.
You were working the system here.
Well, I was better than that. In those days, not many people could type. So I made 75 cents a page typing legal briefs for the law students. Because remember, you had to be a good typist because you couldn't go back and correct it the way you can on a computer. If you got the word wrong, you had to start at the top of the page. So you learn not to make mistakes on the keyboard, which was very handy later on. It makes you fast, which in television, you know, takes care of your problem.
Now, there was one major story that I know happened while you were here. Mm-hmm. Surely you were there.
Oh, yeah, when convention. Alvin Barkley dropped out, sure, 56 mock convention.
Were you a delegate?
No, I was assigned. I was the University News Bureau. That was my assignment. And I was there as a reporter when he died, both as a reporter and as the university's contact with professional reporters who were here. Weren't that many, but there were some. And actually, it was the first time I ever got written up in a newspaper because Charlie McDowell wrote about three of the students who had done professionally well at that event. Philippe Lebreau, who was the French exchange student. Third guy I cannot remember to save my life, and I've long since lost the article that Charlie wrote. And me, because I, generally speaking, I worked the next 72 hours straight answering calls. Many of them from ministers who were terribly upset because the quote had been quoted incorrectly in a number of papers, and they wanted to know why Alvin Barkley was comparing himself to God, and to explain that no, The quote was, "I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than to sit in the seats," plural, "of the mighty." And therefore, he wasn't comparing himself to God. No, no, no. He wanted to be a servant. And I said that enough that I actually came to believe it. But the quote was right. Then later, in 72, because I was in Paris, a couple of university professors, not from here, published a book on great closing lines, like Oscar Wilde's line, "Either the wallpaper goes or I do." And they did the Barclay quote, only they put it in Lexington, Kentucky, got the quote wrong and the date wrong. And it was reviewed in Time magazine, so I wrote Time and they printed the letter, and I've always felt very good about that. Put it to a couple of professors who did research so poorly, they got the wrong state. I mean, that's just, you know. But that was an interesting time.
Take me to the event. What happened?
It is the usual crowded floor, the usual yelling and screaming. It is all men. All the states have their delegates there, and it's. And Barclay is the keynote speaker. I don't know if you ever heard him, but he was an old-fashioned stump orator. He never used a note. His preparation was that he had lived all his life in politics. And he was, you know, thundering on, and some delegate who was obviously either in disagreement with what he had just said, or didn't back the candidate he backed, or didn't like Harry Truman, well, I don't know what, began to heckle him a little bit, which is fine in politics. And Barclay just ate him alive and really caught fire after this guy was heckling. He screamed, "The old fire horse, here's the bell," and just great ramble, and everybody's screaming and applauding, and he said, you know, his closing line, and went straight over backwards. He didn't fall down, he just fell back and was spread-eagled on the rostrum behind the lectern, and he was seriously dead. And so everybody filed out, and then I guess that was it. Mrs. Barclay was taken to wherever they took her. By that time, I was working the phones like crazy. I don't know precisely what happened after he collapsed, because then we were, you know, I was in my university mode and trying to get things done. It was interesting. Great preparation for breaking stories. You know.
I was going to say, that was a real education there.
Mm-hmm. I was watching how the pros did it, and I guess that's when I figured out that most pros are kind of dumb and don't do things very well. There was a guy named, the exception was a guy named Whip Miller. I have no idea where he came from or where he went to, but he had a tape recorder, which in those days, you must understand, were suitcases. They were large, heavy things, and he had gotten a really good recording of the closing lines, and he stayed on the phone, called one radio station after another, one broadcast network after another, and sold the tape recording to all of them. And he did it in about 30 minutes flat.
Wow.
He'd call and say, "Do you want it?" He'd make the connection, play the tape, and take the connectors off, and rewind it while he was telling him where to send the check, so that he could, and make the next call.
That's great.
I mean, say, well, wow, this is how the pros, that, you know, the independent pros make money. You sell it 40 times.
Yep.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little ethically shaky. I don't know. Maybe it's not. I never.
Oh, I don't know. I'm the daughter of a freelance photographer, so no, it's not. Did you come back for any other mock conventions?
No. Uh-uh. I wouldn't have gone to that one, except I was assigned to it. I have no interest in politics. My father was a very minor lieutenant in the Byrd political machine, and 30s, 40s, and 50s. My brother, I guess 7 or 8 years after he left college, became an administrative assistant to a Virginia congressman, and then became a lobbyist, which is sort of the progression. And politics to me, I grew up around it, and wasn't my idea of a good time. I will cheerfully confess that there are journalists who may not be the nicest people you have ever met, but they don't come close to most politicians for not nice. I just didn't want to do that. But it was, you know, Frank was paying me. And if he says go, you say yes, sir, politely, and get your notebook and go. But he had handled all the advanced stuff, and I don't know why he sent me to the event. But he did, so I went.
I guess I was under the impression that mock convention was something everybody participated in.
I don't know. Maybe it is now.
But it wasn't then, but your sense?
I don't know. Because whatever anybody would say to me, I would say I work at the University News Bureau. Mm. So if I would have been required to go, I would have found some way not to. As it was, I found a nice legitimate way because I was employed and working.
How about other traditional Washingtonly things like fancy dress?
Well, I went.
Did you go to fancy
sure,
dress?
Yeah. I went to all the dances, my God. I mean, that's just about the only real organized fun there was. Went to the football games, went tubing in Goshen Pass, did all the, you know, the things that students did in those days. But I didn't go to all of them that I would have. I went to all the dances. But other things, I would sometimes have to work. So I was doing one thing when they were doing something else. There was not much sporting life in those days because there had been a scandal 2 years before and all the first-string football team had been kicked out on honor code violations. And that was the start of what Frank Parsons called Simon Pure Sports at Washington and Lee. And we wrote, I guess, a dozen press releases a week on why Washington and Lee didn't have a football team. Because, you know, people would call up and say, what have you done? And the alumni were all generally furious. And it was just, all scholarships had been, people who were here on the scholarships were honored to their graduation. But no new scholarships for athletics were awarded after that. And I think they're still not. I don't see any indication of any of them anyway. But it was a transitional time. Hadn't begun talking yet about admitting women. That wasn't until the 80s. And I don't know, let's say 57, 70, either my 25th, I guess my 25th reunion, that was a hot topic, or maybe it was the 30th, just don't remember. And I always thought it was a great idea. I had to say that, even if I didn't think it, because my two daughters would have killed me. Two daughters and two sons.
Well, your two daughters aren't here. Did you really think it was a good idea?
Yeah, I did, for a variety of reasons. I went to a military academy from the third grade on, and then I came to Washington and Lee. I had a very hard time socializing with the opposite sex because I had never socialized with the opposite sex. I learned to dance my senior year at Fork Union because Dr. John J. Wicker, a leading light in the Southern Baptist Church, said in church one Sunday morning, quote, dancing is the doing of the devil, unquote. And then he went on to describe why, with rubbing your bodies together. And it sounded like such fun. I spent all my money that summer learning to dance. And so, you know, I got to thank him for that. I've always thought, now, there have been experiments that proved me utterly wrong, one of them going on now in Harlem, that going to school together tends to make you learn how to get along with the opposite sex in the everyday business and scholastic world. And that if you go to a single-sex institution, you somehow get shortchanged. I'm not sure that's true, but I know that's what I believed then and still believe. For most people, I can understand that if there is a shy woman who won't speak up in class, she might be better off with other shy women. But I don't know if that's true either. But I thought it was a good idea. And for one thing, look at what it does to the potential student pool. I mean, you've just gone up 51% in one move. And the young women who are students of mine are, I hate to say this, but they are smarter than the young men who are students of mine. And so far, at least, seem to be more serious about what they're doing.
I'm not quite ready to shift over to professor yet. I do want to do that.
Okay.
There's a couple of things I want to talk about before we go on to
Actually, I can't say anything about professor. I've only been at it for 2 weeks.
I know, but it's interesting. There's something here at Washington and Lee that's not unique, but it's fairly unusual.
Mm-hmm.
The honor system.
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean to you?
Almost nothing, because I'd been under it for 9 years. Same honor system applied at Fork Union. So when I came here, it just, you know, continue doing what you're doing.
Did you see other people struggling with it?
No. I never saw anybody struggle with it. I don't see it around here now the way I saw it then, but it used to be in 57, it was ordinary to walk outside and just put your books on the ground and your bag and your coat, you know, whatever, your overcoat, never your jacket, and go on to what you were doing and then come back and pick them up later. And if it rained, somebody would come along and move them on the porch or on the colonnade or something to get them out of the rain. No one struggled that I know of. Obviously, someone struggled because the whole first string of the football team disappeared, but that was before I got here. Actually, I think it was the year before I got here.
54.
And I was here. Don't remember it at all. Remember the result of it. Because they had gone to what? My brother was very proud of it. They had gone to something, I think it was in those days, called the Orchid Bowl. Whether it even exists anymore. No. Because my brother went, and they had flown over the stadium and dropped a load of orchids out of a small plane. Frank might remember.
I know they talk a lot about the Gator Bowl. That WNL was in.
I don't remember that one at all.
Frank remembers everything. I'll check with him.
Yeah.
Frank.
But I have no memory of it except what my brother talked about. Mm-hmm. So it had to be before he graduated. He graduated in spring of 54.
That's when I think it was happening then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my little red light is flashing, so we're going to flip over.